Our speaker tonight has been attending the GSR meetings at the zone level this year, and it's always really interesting when he speaks because he seems to have this vast well of knowledge about the program and service. So I'm really excited to hear more about his experience with it. And with that, we have Mike.
Dazzle them with your BS, that's what I say.
I'm Mike, and I'm an average alcoholic. Whew, a little nervous tonight. And that's good, God checking the lies out of me. First off, I want to thank everyone here, especially Tim. You know, so I get to blame Tim when this goes wrong. Y'all just reach back there and get him. So, and I got to hear some hoots, so if I don't hear something, I'm going to, you know, my story's going to crash. So please give me something. And welcome. I don't know, are you a visitor? Are you first meeting or trying to?
I am a visitor. I'm also first meeting. My name is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. All right. Yeah. Well, we're glad you're here. I appreciate this opportunity. I want to mention, I always like to mention that I don't speak for AA as a whole, so anything I say that you don't agree with, talk to your sponsor, you know. If you ain't got one, shame on you, you know. I like to tell a story, and some people's heard this many times, and, you know, bear with me, but it's about the little girl. It explains my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about the little girl that wanted to know everything there was to know about everything. And her family couldn't feed that knowledge, you know, that thirst for knowledge. So they gave her all the best teachers, took her to all the best schools, and still it wasn't enough, you know. She just thirsted for knowledge. And so they were talking to somebody, and they said, "Well, if you want to teach your child everything there is to know about everything, you have to go to the mountaintop across the water up the hill, you know, and to the guru with the beard way down." You know, and walks with a cane. And so they said, okay, well, we took her over there. And his gig was that he had these scrolls of knowledge on the wall. And every night by candlelight, she had to read the knowledge. And in the morning, he got up and quizzed her on what she had learned, you know. First morning, she'd been up all night and said, "Well, my child, have you learned everything there is to know about everything?" And she said, "No, Master, I have not." And he walked with a cane. He took that cane, whopped her over the head. You know? So this going on a couple of months, you know, or a month and a half, and she's getting kind of knotty-headed and ain't liking it, you know. Same gig, one morning, she gets up, read the scrolls, gets up, walks out. "Well, my child, have you learned everything there is to know about everything?" "No, Master, I have not." And he reached back with that cane. She reached up and snatched it before he could hit her in the head. And he said, "Oh, my child, you've learned everything there is to know about everything." And she goes, "But, Master, I don't understand." "You've learned how to stop the pain." And that's what, that's my story. I can sit down now and be finished, you know. I'll get on into it. And I like stories, you know. I think we're storytellers in AA. I was born a long time ago, as you can tell, in south side of Atlanta. Me and Tim, we got a lot of similarities, so, you know, I won't try to point to him every time I something. But I've heard Tim's story, and we match. But I spent a lot of time on Stewart Avenue growing up. Wanted to mention that, you know. And if you don't know what Stewart Avenue is, just imagine Buckhead is a Lexus, and Stewart Avenue is a Yugo. For those that remember Yugo, and I won't explain. If you don't know, you can ask me later. So that was Stewart Avenue. I pretty much began my heavy drinking there. I was always, as a child, I remember, you know, everybody says, "Well, you know, I felt different." Well, hell, I was different when I was a child, you know. They said, "Go right," I went left. They said, "Go up," I went down. They said, you know, black, I said white. And, you know. And I knew when I did that, I was going to pay for it. Because there was not this stand in the corner stuff. It was, you know, get serious with it. And now I didn't take beatings as a child. Now I want to, you know, that didn't make me an alcoholic. But I did pay for all my defiance, I call it, you know. And they say alcoholics, you know, that's a defiance is a characteristic of many alcoholics. Being that way, and then growing up, you know, my father was a war hero. Well, he survived World War II, and of course, everybody that survived World War II and got back were war heroes. And he was on the Battle of Iwo Jima, and really good guy, you know. His father was a moonshiner, and the reason I mention this is just to tell you that he never drank a drop of booze in his life, so he wasn't really impressed when I quit drinking, you know. It didn't impress him too much. So, you know, he would always say, well, why don't you just stop for a little while? But his father was a moonshiner. He was the oldest one. He used to have to go fetch him out of the woods, you know. Like I said, he was bad to drink. And my mother's side of the family, all of them, they're Central Georgia sharecroppers. They were all, you know, they're all raging alcoholics, you know. Even about four of them told me when I got in the program, oh, yeah, we've been to AA, you know. Yeah, it just, you know, it doesn't work for us, but yeah. You know, and I told them I got sober, you know. But there was no alcohol in my home. My mother liked to drink occasionally when she'd hook up with her sisters, but other than that, you know. But I think there was a few other things, and I don't know that for certain, but I heard arguments when I was a child, you know. Now, that didn't make me an alcoholic, hearing that. But when I mixed that booze and them other things on top of that defiance, boy, it just bubbled up, you know, and it just said, you know, welcome to the world. You're going to show them what you got. And I didn't have much, and I didn't show them much, but I tried to do it, you know, as much as I could. But growing up, I remember, I don't think I stopped drinking from a junior in high school. You know, I don't think I pretty much ever went, you know, too long being sober. Remember one stretch, one time I was in the hospital for 7 days, got an infection from a surgery, and I was married, and I told my wife, I said, she was actually a nurse in the hospital, and when she come to get, I said, when you pick me up, you've got to have a cooler full of beer. And being the good, untreated person she was, you know, she showed up just like that, cooler full of beer. But I didn't do well when I did without. And so I wouldn't drink, I wouldn't take other substances without having enough. I'll just put it that way. So when I came into AA and I heard that you went through this craving, you had these cravings, I said, I've never really craved a drink, you know. I heard a speaker one time, a guy explained it to him, says, well, some of us slug them down so fast and have so much that the craving doesn't have a chance to sit in, you know. And that made perfect sense to me, because I would not start, you know, without having plenty. Like I said, I won't go into a big drunkalogue because I think we all probably qualify sitting if, you know, our seats here. One story I won't mention, one story in, about walking, trying to walk through Hartsfield landing, you know, the airport, out on the airport. I was in East Point one night and I wanted to go home, and I was just toast, you know. And coming from East Point, I lived in Riverdale, and I said, well, if I walk around the south side, if you know anything, through Fairburn, I'll be there tomorrow afternoon. If I walk around the north side, I might be there at, you know, 10 in the morning. I said, but I bet if I walk right straight through the airfield, I'd be there, you know, before daylight. And they had just opened it, you know, they had just opened the new Hartsfield, you know, and there I go. And I imagine myself sneaking through, you know, but I'm sure I was, you know, wobbling around. And if it was in today's environment, I'd have been in Guantanamo, you know. So where'd Mike go? I don't know. He's just not around anymore, you know. So, but I do qualify. I did things like live in shacks with guys when I had a home to go to, you know, and you know, just the whole. So I don't have to get into that. So that's kind of what I was like, you know, or what it was like. What happened was in 1989, I'd gotten married. My wife had three children, two girls and me. And she got tired of it. You know, she'd had enough of it. She had left one time, went to Colorado and come back. And she came back pregnant. And, you know, and I thought I could accept that, and I would have, but she terminated that. The baby toward the end there. And so one night she went out, and she was going to go out. She said, well, I'm going out with some friends of mine, and I'm going to a movie. The grandkids are down at her mother's. You know, she'd see me later. So I'm at home doing my thing, you know, and I, I'm an alcoholic now, but I did other things like boost a lot of cocaine. And I wanted to throw that out there because this story doesn't make a lot of sense if you don't know that. Before I knew it, I was finished up with everything, and then my back sliding door, you know, the sliding door where you can pick it up off the track and slide it, you know. Here comes the narcotics unit, you know, the county that I was living in. And she had went down and swore out a warrant at the narcotics unit. They went to a judge, got a warrant, and in the back door they come. There I am, you know, and they're parading me around the room with spread out like Jesus Christ, you know, because it showed the marks and everything. And they would stop at one daughter's bedroom and say, "Don't you see what you're doing?" You know, they weren't there, but this is what you're doing. Stop at another daughter's bedroom, you know, and, you know, what are you doing? And, of course, you know, then you go to lock up. And you can't get out on a normal bond on a situation like that. They don't have a, you know, like a DUI. So I had to wait, and it was the weekend. It was July 15th, 1989. There I'm sitting. Now, I had been locked up many times for misdemeanors, DUIs, you name it. I had about 16 priors, you know, misdemeanors, while under the influence. You know, everything was this while under the influence. I was in a bar over an old National Highway sitting there falling asleep on the table. The guy kept telling me, you know, about six times, "If you keep doing this, we're going to call the cops," you know. "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And then I, boom, hit the table again. And about the sixth time, you know, the finest rolled in there and took me to jail. So things like that, you know, over and over and over. But you kind of get used to that, you know. I did. Because you can get bailed out on things like that pretty quick, and you know, if you have any friends, and then you're on your merry way. Well, this wasn't that same situation. Of course, it was a felony. You know, there I sat. The third day I was in there, they called my name, you know, Satterfield, front and center. I run down there, and somebody's come to get me. They said, "Sign for this, please." And I signed it. Divorce papers right there, you know. It's like, God, can this get any worse, you know? Of course, you know, when you're in that situation, all you want to do is just, I wanted to die, you know. I had to survive, and I missed my kids. And when I went home, when I finally did get out and went home, the doors, all the locks on the doors were changed, you know, obviously. Talking about, well, you know, that should, any normal person, that should scare them straight, right? That should, I mean, they should wake up to the fact that maybe what they're doing is not working, you know. Oh, hell no, not me, you know, because I'm hard-headed, I'm defiant, and I'm going to figure this out myself. And so during this period, oh, let me back up. 2 weeks after I was arrested, I was leaving Stewart Avenue, West Texas Music Club, and got a DUI running 105 miles an hour down 75, just drunk as a cooter. And I never drove fast, you know. I never sped. So I've got this DUI pending, this felony pending, and, you know, so when I go to, because you go to court on the lesser charge first, the judge looks at it, and he's looking at my priors, and he's going, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And he goes, "Well, they're going to throw him in jail anyway, so I'm going to let him stay out," you know. And they let me out, but I had to go to two AA meetings a week. That was part of it. 250 hours of community service and pay the fine, you know. And they suspended my license as well, you know. But they gave me the little ticket, and I thought, well, I can drive on this ticket, you know, because I'm an imitation intellectual. I forgot to mention that when I got up here. You know, I'm a pretty smart guy, you know. And well, y'all could probably tell is listening to me talk. But anyway, so I'm going to AA meetings, you know, jumped right in it. Immediately started walking and got to running because my nerves was out of sight, and the alcohol was just dropping from me, you know, every day, sweating off of me, you know. And I had stopped the alcohol. I had stopped the other substances. But there was a few small things, you know, no big deal, that I just couldn't put down, because I don't do sobriety. I don't do sober without a substitute. And Alcoholics Anonymous has become my substitute. You know, it works in every situation because I've got the big stick, my higher power, you know, on my side. So I got through the court on that. They gave me 5 years on paper. Said, well, you know, we're going to make an example. That was when they were saying, just say no. You remember that period? Just say no, you know, and we're going to get hard on cocaine. All mine was powder, but they was really pressing the crack, you know. That was the thing. I'm out. House arrest. They didn't put me in. The last morning, the DA said, you know, we got house arrest, Judge. Will you let him go to house arrest? Because the judge says he's doing time because of the priors. House arrest. 4 years. Go to one more AA meeting a week, a total of 3 a week. You've got to be in by 7 o'clock every night. Can't leave your county unless you work or go to AA meetings. Got it. But I'm still slipping around. They want a drug test. I'm slipping around. I don't know how I passed those tests. Still slipping around because I don't do sobriety. I need something to take the edge off, and it has to be something with weight. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous is my substitute today, because it's got substance, you know. But I just don't do life, you know. Life is heavy. You know, everybody knows that, right? So I'm still slipping around. I'm going to my group. I'm in an AA group. They vote me GSR and know that I'm slipping around. Now, that's love, if you ask me. I mean, really. They know you can tell, you know, we're not stupid. So they vote me in. I'm going to Macon. You know, they had the GSSA in Macon at that time. I'm going down there telling everybody how wonderful it is and going back to my room and playing around, you know. What a, you know, imitation intellectual, man. I've got it all figured out. I had to make amends for that little trick, too. And when I finally got sober and made those amends, everybody I went to down there and told them, you know, what I'd been doing, they said, we know. We're just glad you're sober now. I mean, that's some unconditional love, ain't it? Because they wanted to give me a chance. You know, I was trying. So, but what the last straw was that I had been going to AA for 7 years now, playing this little game. You know, because, again, I'm smarter. I got home from a meeting. I chaired a meeting one night. I took a piece of paper, laid it down, and wrote 3 ways to kill myself. I was serious. You know, I could not live. My soul was dead. You know, and this is what it took for me to even try what you had. I wanted what you had. I knew I needed what you had. But I wanted what I had. You know, and I was so scared to losing what I had, trying yours, till the thought of if I didn't try it, I was going to lose it all. You know, and that fear overtook everything. I believe I've heard a speaker say that a power within us and a power outside of us, and when those come to match, then we can get sober, you know. And I had met a man, and this little story was a divine intervention as far as I'm concerned. First off, the guy that I had, during that period of faking sobriety, I call it, I used to let people stay with me. You know, I'd have people, I was a member of the Terror Club. You know, not in good standing, but I was a member of the Terror Club. So I would have people were trying to get sober that come stay with me. And there was a guy, Danny. And Danny was a good, but he had a problem with crack. And he couldn't keep it, put it down. And, you know, and of my ignorance, you know, I thought, why can't he just stop? Now that's ignorance and a little bravado there going on, you know. Mixed, but Danny had lived with me, and then he moved out, and he was doing better. And I run into him. Through my employer, I went over to his business. We were buying stuff from them, and he said, "Man, I found this group. This guy Joe, he's amazing. You know, he's got these steps down." He said the trick is the steps. That's the only way you're going to get sober, you know. And I thought Danny knew that I was sober. Danny knew I wasn't sober. I'd never told Danny I wasn't sober. He says, man, that's it. So he says, come over to this group. This particular night, I'm going to tell my story. I said, okay. So I went down to that group. Danny was sick with the flu. So I meet Joe. I get Joe's number. I go back again once to that meeting, and then right before my sobriety date is January 6, 96, and the end of December, I said, Joe, I called him. I said, I'm dying. I can't live like this anymore, you know. I said, you got to help me, you know. And I didn't know Joe from Adam's House Cat, you know. And he said, well, we're going to go through these steps. He says, the only condition is that if a man comes to you and asks you to take him through the steps, you cannot refuse. And, of course, I'd have done anything, you know, at that point. Because I had lost that pain, and that death of my soul had ground all that resistance to dust, you know. It said, you're going to do what's being asked of you, and you're not. Because Joe's thing was, the time for yeah buts and I knows are over. You know, either you do this thing, you're going to have to quit playing around. And I was so scared that I couldn't get sober being in AA for 7 years. I thought I was the one we read about, you know, that we're constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves. And I really believe that. You know, I was walking around crazy. People would ask me what was going on in those last days. I mean, I was just a shell of a person. So Joe, we met in another place down there on the south side. It's called Clayton House, in a back room, and we did the took the first step. I wouldn't even take a white chip before I took the first step. I want to back up. Took the steps. We read. And you know, these are the steps we took. You know, it doesn't say these are the steps we worked. These are the steps that we're, you know, being pushed through. You know, these are the steps we took, which in that meaning means pledged. We've took a pledge to these steps and to the principles behind them, you know. And I used to say that I worked the steps and, you know, Joe helped me get sober. And then I said, Joe pushed me through the steps. But I believe the willingness with a higher power's assistance helped me take those steps. And, of course, we go through and I got serenity in those steps, you know. I think I got addicted to the serenity the same I was to the alcohol and drugs, you know. It was a turning point. But, you know, you're in the steps. It's your early sobriety, you know, life's tough. You're going, you're trying to turn your wheel over, you know, and you're trying to work. And I heard another story about, you know, rowing the boat. I'm rowing the boat as I do life because life sucks, you know. That's the way it used to be. Life sucks and you die, you know. But I'm rowing the boat. Early sobriety, you know. I've got to do this. Okay. Well, let's go, God. I'm rowing that boat and you know, and damn it, some days I don't want to row the boat. Because God's up there on the rudder and he's steering. And I said, God, I want to steer. Anytime, Mike, come on and steer. I don't row. God says, I don't row. So I'm out there in the lake and I'm giving it, you know, this. And I'm going nowhere, you know. But I'm steering. I like that analogy. I was in so much pain in early sobriety. It was a different kind of pain. It was kind of a pain of acceptance that I would start driving home from work. I worked in Conyers, lived in Jonesboro at the time. And I would get halfway home and I'd have to get out and start screaming. I don't know. I imagine myself screaming at God, but I don't know what I was screaming at. You know, I was crying, you know. I couldn't even drive home. I said, if this is what I got to do, this is what I'm going to do, you know. And so I you know, got tapes and CDs, and that would quiet my mind long enough for me to get home, you know. But like I said, as I took these steps and took these pledges and took these, you know, things, I, experienced a serenity that I don't believe I'd ever had, you know, even as a child. I was able to get through the steps. We got into the traditions. Fascinating adventure there. I think we maintained this thirst for sobriety and for things about the program. I had to know everything there was to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to know everything there was, because if this was going to be my life and my, you know, I wanted to know it. Joe was astute with the history of AA, and but one thing he gave me is he gave me his time. And that's a fascinating thing to have, you know. Somebody will give you their time. It's easy to open up your wallet and give a couple of bucks or buy a meal or things like that. But to give somebody your time, what a sacrifice. And that's what happened. So what's it like today? Well, let me say one thing back about how it was. When I always went drinking, I always started drinking before I started drinking. Can you relate to that? You know, I could not start drinking with quote-unquote normal drinkers. I had to start drinking, and then I went out drinking. Because I knew if somebody caught me without enough alcohol, I just wasn't, you know, and it wasn't going to be good, because that washer machine was going to start in spin cycle about not enough. Not enough, and it starts getting faster and faster and faster. So I failed to mention that. I always want to mention that. You know, a lot of people relate to that. I see it. You know, a lot of people always shake their head. Yeah. We started drinking before we started drinking. But what it's like today? When I got sober, I was able to go to college at age 42. There was a trend in AA. I don't know what it was, but a lot of people were going to college, you know, after they got sober. And I wanted a degree before I died. You know, I wanted to be able to say that I had a degree. And so I went in West Georgia, 5 years sober. I don't know how crazy I really am. So if you're 5 years sober, be careful. No big steps. I sold a house, quit a job I'd had for 18 years, and moved to Bumble. You know, and I said, what am I going to do now? I'm going to go to college. So, you know, I thought me and the rabbits and the deer and everybody would kumbaya out in the woods, and we'd all be happy. 5 years sober, watch out. There's a guy, Chet, you know, that says, if you're saying you're not far enough along in the program in early stages, say, well, don't worry. Bill didn't write the big book till almost 5 years sober, so, you know, you still got time, you know. But I was out there in the woods and sober and going to meetings. You know, I was still going to plenty of meetings, and I didn't realize the major that I had was going to require a state license. And I failed to go, you know, smart again, imitation intellectual, failed to go to the website to figure out that anybody with a felony would not qualify for this job. But I'm trucking through school, and I'm the honor roll, you know, because I'm paying for my education, and I'm sober. I'm wearing that SRS t-shirt, you know, stark raving sober, you know, and I'm trouncing through life, you know. I get ready to graduate. I say, well, I'm going to be proactive and go ahead and get my testing and licensing. I go to the website. Bam. If you've had a prior felony conviction, the odds of you or something, you're probably not going to be able to get a license. Wow. So, but they didn't check with God. There were certain conditions you had to meet, and if you meet these conditions, you know, well, the board will take a look at it. And again, God had more to say in that matter. So I go and I get all the affidavits, character affidavits, you know, compile a bunch of information, show that all my sentences and everything's completed, and the board meets and allows me to get my license, you know. And that was in real estate, and then I made a ton of money for about 4 years, and then the market busted. You know, I had all my eggs in that basket. So what am I going to do, you know? And my father, during this time, my mother, I told you there was other things in the house, and I think my mother, when she retired, kind of leaned heavy on some of them. We had to do an intervention, one of the toughest things I ever had to do, and she was supposed to go to AA meetings, and I would ask her when I'd go to Gainesville, I'd say, "You been to your meetings, Mom?" "Nah, you know, those people over there, I don't find anything, I have anything in common with those people." So anyway, she laid down one day and never woke up, and my father was in stage two of dementia. And I was self-employed, and I was able to, you know, kind of fill in the gap, you know. And I was always the one stealing out of her purse, stealing from his wallet, you know, stealing everything. And suddenly I'm thrust into the middle of being the, you know, I've got an older sister. She's a professional. I've got a younger sister with 7 children that she's homeschooling. And nobody, you know, I was there. AA has given me some tools to start dealing with this. So I go in, I'm taking Dad, you know, and he gets 3 years in, he's can't no longer walk, you know, and he's getting nonverbal. And, you know, it's a nasty, nasty thing if you've ever had to deal with it. And but you know, that experience changed me, you know. It really, you know, it gave me understanding of unconditional love. You know, even to this time, you know, I'm 18 years sober at that point, and, you know, but it changed me. And so I told him, you know, before he quit speaking, I said, "Well, you know, as long as my health holds up, I'll keep you at home." You know, he was deaf. His mother had spent years and years in a home, and it was not pretty. And, I said, "As long as I can," and he passed it home. And it changed me, you know. But there I am, 6 years taking care of him, and I've spent every dime I got. I'm back. I'm basically almost homeless again, you know. Well, I'm not fretting, because a friend of mine said, "Keep AA and God first, and everything works out," you know. Remember that job that I left for 18 years? I went back and reapplied. I figured I would never. I had a retirement with them, and I left it in. I left it in the system. Smartest thing I ever did. Had somebody advise me before I left. Said, "Just leave it in, small amount of money. Let it grow, you know, get it when you're 60. I'm 54 years old, got to go back to work. And they hire me in. It's a state job. They hire me in at the bottom. Even non-permanent job, picking up dead animals off the side of the road and toting 80-pound sacks of concrete. I'm 54 years old. It liked to kill me for 6 months. I mean, I almost died, you know. But I got in good shape fast, you know. And that worked into a permanent status job in a different area. That worked into another job, and I ended up retiring in 2020 with 24 years, you know, from that company. And was able to pull that. Not a lot of money, but it's better than a sharp stick in the eye. That's what I tell everybody, you know. It's constant till I die. But what that did was springboard me into consulting with the same company, and they treat me well. These things, we never know how they're going to turn out, right? I mean, we've got it all figured out. Don't make specifications for your life. You'll sell yourself short. One other story. I'm about to the end. This didn't go anything like what I thought it was going to go like. There's one story I like to tell about early sobriety. I was 6 months sober. I had been to the Allatoona Roundup and almost got drunk. And I had to take a business trip. And I didn't get drunk. You know, I got sucked in by AA up there and a bunch of AA members. You know, I was willing, just willing enough, you know, not to drive back to Atlanta and get drunk. So I was going to Florida on a business trip. I had to go down there and look at some things we had ordered. You know, and I'm always driving drunk cars when I had drunk, you know, when I was drunk. So I've always got a toolbox in the trunk. God had given me in my earlier years a a mechanical sense, and I was pretty good with cars, you know. So I always took it with me. Driving down there, I'm riding down, you know where, Unadilla on 75. I'm going to Stark, Florida. I think it's Stark. Is it Stark? Got a Floridian up here in the front. Unadilla, Georgia, bam. Car quits. I know exactly what it is. Broken timing belt. Yeah, it's the only thing it could be. Won't turn over. When I turn the engine won't spin, you know, timing belt's broke. So I'm sitting there. I said, I got my tools. I'm making a specification. Got my tools. There's an exit right up there. I go up there. There's a parts store up there. I go up there. I get my car towed back to that. There's an oak tree in a truck turnaround right there. I'm going to get my car down there, tear it down, put the timing belt on it, be on my merry way. Yes. All right. Specifications. I'm walking down the exit. I'm coming down, you know, and I'm thinking, the closer I get to the exit, the more I'm thinking, you're full of shit. You don't know where you're at. You don't know how you're going to get this done, you know. So here comes the prayer. God help me. And I continue walking toward the exit. In 10 seconds over the shoulder, Mike, a friend of mine from Atlanta was going to a retirement party in Tifton, recognized my car and backed up on the shoulder and picked me up. And I didn't even like this guy at work. Picks me up. He had lived down there and moved to Atlanta to work with the business. And he was from down there, knew all the wrecker drivers. He was in vehicle maintenance. You know, he says, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put your keys under the floorboard. I'm going to get my wrecker driver to pick it up, take it tipped into the Honda dealer, slap a timing belt on it. They took me to the retirement party, fed me. Fed me. And I was on my way in 2 hours. My plan, I would have been camping out under that oak tree in the back seat of my car, you know, still trying to get it fixed, you know. So, you know, God works, you know. It's been great being up in here. I do this hesitantly because I do a lot in AA. I try to do a lot in AA, you know, service-wise, because, you know, it's, y'all have given me so much, I could never repay you. You know, there's not enough I can do in AA. And when I leave, you know, I do it hesitantly, but my cup is always runneth over, you know. So I try to do things and try to be available. You know, if I can be there and put my hand out when another one shows up, you know, what a blessing. Because there was a lot of people that sacrificed a lot of time and effort into me. But it took what it took, and it takes what it takes. And, you know, I wish you much peace in your as you trudge the road of destiny. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into Take me where the promise is.